Hey, Deserving listeners, just me today. I thought I would answer some patron emails. And before getting into it, I should tell you all that I'm sick today. Not terribly sick, but you might be able to hear it in my voice. I have a cough. It's not COVID, but I think I got it while I was visiting family in Spokane, Washington. And I haven't been sick in 4 years. I never got COVID, as far as I know. And I am reminded how much I hate being sick, but this is pretty minor. And I might have to pause so I can cough. I also had to cancel all these plans that I had this week. I had all these really fun plans, and every day Stacy and I would wake up and we'd be like, so we can't go to that thing tonight. I mean, we're still sick and contagious. It's not good. every day we've been canceling. And by the way, if you know, when this episode airs, it'll be after the fact that I recorded it right now. So just so you know, it's late July right now. And if you see on Instagram, I'm out and about in mid-August or something, that's because I will have recovered. I mean, my doctor even said I'm probably out of the woods contagious-wise even today, but I don't want to take a risk. I mean, whoever gave this to me didn't mind taking that risk, but I don't want to take that risk. But anyway, so let's get into it. Anonymous middle-tier patron, they say, hi, Dr. Honda. You mentioned in, and by the way, as I'm talking right now, my head is all stuffed up, so it's a little hard to talk into the microphone. It's a different experience. Again, I haven't been sick in so long. Anyway, hi, Dr. Honda. You mentioned in one of your reaction videos that when you have a compassion, sorry, let me start. Okay. Let me drink some honey water. Oh my God, that was hotter than I realized it was. I'm falling apart here, my friends. Okay. Hi, Dr. Honda. You mentioned in one of your reaction videos that when you have a compassionate conceptualization of a person, you're not excusing their behavior or saying that other people should put up with it. Yeah, just chiming in here. So if you don't watch my reaction videos, there are times when I will be reacting to a cast member that it seemingly is exhibiting abusive behavior, a pattern of abusive controlling behavior. And so I will label it as such. I don't know precisely what's happening with these couples on these shows, but I will say this looks like this, or this would be the top hypothesis I would have if I were to start assessing this client in my office. And then I would say, of course, abuse is wrong and it's horrible. And here are some reasons to why some people become abusive or exhibit abusive behavior. It's often due to childhood trauma themselves. It doesn't excuse it, of course, but here's what it kind of looks like to me, given the style of abuse that this person or the style of personality that this person has. Here's some top hypotheses that I would have regarding what to explore with them if they were to ask me for help with their abusive behavior. And for a long time, I would talk along those lines. And some people would comment below on the YouTube, because this issue doesn't, I don't think, come up as much on the podcast, the audio podcast, but it would come up a lot in the reaction videos. Anyway, so in the comment section, some people would say, so Kirk, you know, when you have that compassionate or that explanation of why that abusive person is abusive, it really makes me think that you're telling me that I should go back to my abusive husband, or I should excuse my abusive wife, or I should try to help my abusive parents with their problems because they come from trauma. And I would say, oh, no. That is not what I'm saying. First and foremost, do not expose yourself to abuse. I would even say, when I, as a person who treats people who are abusive and has, I guess what you would, I don't call it a compassionate conceptualization of abusers. I call it an accurate conceptualization of abusers. So I'm not trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. I'm trying to figure out why in the hell these people do these sorts of things. I mean, because when, you know, often when people will characterize abusive people, it's as if they're psychopaths. They wake up in the morning and go, ha 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 ha, I'm going to ruin other people's lives. People like that exist. They're rare. Most abusers are not like that. Most abusers are actually trying in a very twisted criminal way, trying to establish what we all want, which is secure attachments. But because of their defenses and their triggers and the distortions and their indoctrination into certain gender ideas, they will exhibit abusive behavior. This will make it okay. But anyway, so even though I will see people that way in my life, say I have someone in my life who is abusing me, and I know enough about their childhood to know where it comes from, I still will figure out a way to get away from that person. Not just distance, I will figure out a way to end my relationship. I don't want to be anywhere near that person. I have what some would call a compassionate conceptualization. I would call it an accurate conceptualization. And yet, I do not give a shit. I am not put on this planet to sacrifice myself for other people's trauma. You know, if they come to me as a client, which of course they couldn't because I know them, but if another person came to me with the exact same problem as a client and hired me to work with them, then I would do so, absolutely. And I would have compassion, and I would lean into the relationship, and I would put up with whatever kind of counter or whatever sort of transference they have towards me, whether it be demeaning me or, you know, I've put up with a lot of stuff as a therapist, and I don't, you know, reject clients for having the problems that they came to me in the first place with, right? But in my personal life, with work colleagues, with acquaintances, with extended family, no, I do not take that shit. I will instantly, in fact, I've talked about this before, but I have run into this in my personal life, and I won't go into specifics, but I once immediately distanced myself. In fact, I'll go into a little bit of the specifics. So this was years and years and years ago, but I was in a group of friends, and I met a new member of this group of friends. And other people in this group of friends had known this guy for a long time, and I didn't know this guy for very long. And so I accepted him because all these friends really liked him and had a history with him. And so over time, I started noticing that this new guy was abusing the other members of this group, not me. But he was abusing emotionally and verbally other people in this group. And it bothered me. I thought, that guy is abusive, I think. And he's not doing it to me. It still hurts to watch it. But I swear to God, if he turns on me, which I'm pretty sure he's going to do once he's comfortable enough with me, then I'm out. I'm out. I'm done, not only with him, but maybe with the whole group, because who am I to say get rid of that guy? I mean, you know, this group was kind of solid. It had been together for years. So when that day occurred, which it did, because I predicted it as such, that he did turn on me and started to abuse me slightly, but I was like, I knew where this was headed. And I'm like, nope, I'm done. Life's too short, and I'm not going to subject myself to that kind of abuse. And so I told people in this group that I was going to be separating myself in certain ways, drawing boundaries, which meant that I wouldn't be able to hang out with them as much anymore because of this other guy. And they said, oh, okay, yeah, he's, you know, they also agreed, yeah, this other guy, he does that a lot, and it's not a good thing, but we don't know what to do about it. We've tried to talk with him about it, and I said, yeah, totally cool, and no harm, no foul, and I'm sorry that I have to do this, but I have a policy that I don't deal with that kind of stuff. So I distanced myself, and then some people from this group actually came to me and said, well, wait, so are you saying that it's okay for us to draw a boundary with him? Because it was a new concept to them that they didn't have to put up with this shit anymore. And long story short, it changed the whole dynamic moving forward. And a number of these guys also decided that they were going to draw a boundary, not as firm as me, because I don't know, because I'm an expert on this, I can see it a mile away. I'm like, oh, he's abusive and I'm not his therapist, so I can't help him. So I'm helpless and powerless in the face of his abuse, and I'm watching him abuse other people. And if he's an abusive person, he'll find out a reason to abuse me. And there he goes, abusing me. So I am done dealing with this. So that's what I do. Now, I would say that sometimes, and I realized this late in the game as a podcaster, that I would have to say it. And at first it felt a little funny that I would have to say that, that I would have to say, yeah, I mean, just because I have a therapist's point of view of an abusive person, that doesn't mean that you need to stick around with abusive people. It felt funny that I had to say that out loud, because I don't know, I just hadn't heard enough stories, but I heard a lot more stories along these lines. And then I realized, oh, this is clear. This isn't just a one-off, one-person kind of issue. This is a very common reaction among the listeners. And I better make sure that I emphasize this more often. And I sort of forgot about it, and I didn't do it very often. And then I was reminded about it again. And so I've been doing it more and more lately. But anyway, going on with the email here. So you mentioned in one of your reaction videos that when you have a compassionate conceptualization of a person, you're not excusing their behavior or saying that other people should put up with it. Your compassion and lack of judgment are some of the things I appreciate the most about your content, but I have noticed that sometimes those things that I love are also the reasons I have to step back from it. Sometimes when I hear these compassionate conceptualizations of people who behave in ways that are reminiscent of my past abusive situations, my own guilt will rise up to reframe your compassionate words and reasons to put myself down or open myself up to allowing these people back into my life. When that happens, I say to myself, what they did was inexcusable, it was wrong, what this abusive person did was despicable, etc. I'm willing to take that stance in order to protect myself. But it feels very black and white. And on a macro level, it doesn't feel like it leaves much room for things like redemption for the abusive person. Do you have thoughts about how we can develop our ability to be comfortable with nuance, to accept and clearly state that certain behaviors are harmful while leaving people room to change and grow? End of email. Yeah. So what I will say is, it's sort of, you know, people use this metaphor too often, but I think it's apt, that when you're on the airplane and there's a decompression and the oxygen masks fall from the ceiling, that you're supposed to put yours on first before you put your children's mask on, right? And the same goes, you know, it's a metaphor for this, in that the first thing that you as abuse survivors should be paying attention to is yourself. Selfishly taking care of yourself, getting safe, that's the number one thing. You ask any first responder, and the number one thing is safety, 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 and then you can start to treat people, right? Because if there's a bunch of fires around and you rush in and you try to treat someone with their burns and everyone else, including yourself, are getting burned by the fires, that's no good, right? So even though you see the opportunity to help someone, so for yourself, anonymous middle tier patron, you see the opportunity to help someone in your life who was traumatized and has a problem with abusive behavior, the first thing is you need to take care of yourself. You need to get to safety. You need to recover. And this process of getting safe and recovering can take decades. So it's not something that you do in an hour. This phase of what I'm framing is, and I'm using the word selfish purposely because so many of my clients would say, well, I don't know, it feels selfish. And I'd be like, fine, it's selfish. Let's just say it's selfish and say selfishness is justified in a lot of situations, this one particularly. So be selfish, be self-interested, be narcissistic, as the internet will call it. Be, self-preservationists. You need to take care of yourself. So that's number one. So who cares about the abusive person at this point? They are not a part of your responsibility. So get yourself to safety, then start recovering. Then after that process, you can begin to put the mask on the other person in the airplane, or you are in a place where you can maybe begin to help the other person to redeem themselves or open yourself up to them in a boundaried way. The issue here is not only do you deserve to have that safety and recovery independent of any kind of pull back to that abusive relationship, but also pre-recovery, you're very vulnerable to giving in to the gaslighting that you have experienced. And that's something that I also underappreciated, that when I provide a compassionate slash accurate point of view of an abusive person, it very much pulls on the heartstrings of the gaslighted victim. There were so many messages and so many experiences that the victim went through, maybe even before the abusive relationship, that told them that the victim doesn't matter, that it's their job to take care of the abusive person, that kind of thing, that the abusive person suffers, right? A lot of abusive people will exhibit or highlight their suffering either in a disingenuous way or in a genuine way, but the end result is that it keeps the victim victimized, right? So when I talk about compassionate slash accurate points of view of these abusive people, it inadvertently, that's not the reason why I'm doing it, obviously, but it will influence victims to open themselves up in a variety of ways to the abusive person. And so I'm glad that you, patron, do that to yourself, that when I talk it in this way and you feel that pull to open yourself up, you immediately slam the door shut and say, you know, things to yourself like, what they did was inexcusable, it was wrong, what that person did was despicable, and I don't need to involve myself with that person, and that's good. And so it's almost like with this email and a few others, I feel like there's like a third phase. You know, the first phase was I was ignorant of this need. And then the second phase was I would occasionally remind people, by the way, because I'm providing a compassionate point of view doesn't mean that you go back to the person. I personally draw a firm boundary with abusive people as soon as I can. But there's a third phase, which is even if I say that, it might not really address the problem for these individuals. That given, I might have to say something directly to this category, of which it's a large category of people, right? To say something like, so even though I'm saying this is what I would do is draw boundaries, if you are pre-significant recovery, then it might actually be harmful for you to listen to this kind of content, because no amount of me telling you that you deserve to recover or you deserve to have boundaries or you deserve to protect yourself will be sufficient to truly uncloud your mind from the gaslighting that you've experienced that you have yet to recover from. Yeah, that's a long way of putting it, but you know what I mean? It feels like maybe I should be saying those kinds of things as well. All right, next email. But first, let's take a break. All right, we're back from the break. Ugh, I took some cold medicine and I think it might be working, but I don't know. It's so weird. I feel like I can think straight, but maybe not. I can't tell. Anyway, I wanted to do an OPP. These people became patrons all the way back in the end of 2020 and have stayed patrons ever since. We have Rachel from Boise, Idaho. These are all upper tier or middle tier patrons. We have Chris from Huntington Beach, California, which I've been to before when I was in high school. And I remember I got a custom-made ring. It just said Kirk, I think, and someone like carved it. Rebecca, Georgia is from Great Britain. We have Emma from Oklahoma City. Oklahoma, you stole my basketball team. Thank you very much. Just joking, but not really. Leslie from Texas. We have Alana from California. We have Caitlin from Utah. And we have, these are the next group of people are all just regular patrons, also very deserving people. Eliza from Texas, these are all annual patrons, sorry. Eliza from Texas, Austin, Texas, which I've been to. In fact, one of the original co-hosts, Lisa Katibi, lives in Austin. Layla from Switzerland, CH is Switzerland, right? Willie from Berlin, Germany. We got Mindy from Minnetonka, Minnesota. We have Jennifer, annual patron from Quincy, Mass. We have Amber from Richmond, British Columbia, beautiful Richmond, British Columbia, Chanel from San Diego, Desiree from San Pablo, California, Francisca from Germany, Julie from God knows where, Christine from God knows where, Marlene from God knows where, or Christiane, sorry, from God knows where, Mattias from Sweden. Yeah, Sweden. These country codes are hard. I wish they had more than two letters. Don't you think it would be easier if it was more than two letters? Because S-E, Sweden. Anyway, we got Ty from Douglasville, Pennsylvania, Talisha from Fairhaven, Mass. We have Nina from Stockholm, Sweden. And we have Jay from Florence, Mass. A lot of Massachusetts people. M-A is Massachusetts, right? Because M-S is Mississippi. Yeah, I think M-A is Massachusetts. Thank you for becoming a patron and staying a patron through thick and thin, even though, well, there's a joke in there about how thick the snot is in my sinuses right now. Thank you for sticking with me through thick and thin. You're as thick as the snot in my sinuses. By the way, another thing I want to remind people of is that this year, I've been trying to make our business, Psychology in Seattle, carbon neutral. So I have been, I invested in solar panels for our house, which is home office. That's what we do all day as work. And there's a fair amount of electricity used to, you know, if we had an office somewhere, we'd be using heat and AC and lights and computer. There's a fair amount of computer power that goes into rendering videos. Anyway, and I also, it gives you this app that you can see minute by minute how much power you're using. I mean, imagine having that for your house where you could look at exactly how much power you're using every minute of the day. And it's really alerted me to some issues, right? With like, oh, we're using way too much power at that hour of the night. We need to do this and that, you know, and I felt like I was doing pretty good anyway, but I'm kind of obsessed with it. And so it's my house, but it's also a home business. And now also in Washington State, we primarily use reusable energy resources anyway, hydroelectric, wind. So I just wanted you to know that your time with me as a customer of this business, particularly if you're a paying customer, that you're not contributing to a business that is pumping carbon into the sky, which is a problem. I mean, another sort of thing about this is that I almost never leave the house. So I don't drive my car. So I don't use that kind of energy as well. Stacy leaves the house more than I do. I mean, I'll go for 2 weeks without leaving my house. Not that I don't do anything. People come to my house. I'm like, hey, come over here, and because I'm lazy that way. All right. Oh, do cold medicines make you a little goofy and drunk? I feel that way. Let's read another email. Oh, by the way, while I'm in the unstructured post-break zone, I want to reflect a little bit about the episodes that I published a couple of weeks ago with my mom. And boy, was that a journey and meaningful to me. And I know a lot of you responded or liked the episodes, you know, the comments and whatnot, emails. And yeah, I'm glad that for those of you that appreciated it, that you did, because it I don't know what, how do I say? I will say that I've had conversations like that with my mom before, but there was something concentrated about having that conversation on the podcast that led to us getting pretty deep in that third episode. You know, just a little background on that. I never knew that because me and my siblings frequently shower my parents with praise. Sometimes I'll catch a glimpse of a card that my brother will send my parents, and it'll be, I'm just a terrible card writer. I was even telling my wife that I feel like maybe I should use AI to help me write cards better. I'm not very good at it. But my siblings will write these really great cards to my parents, being really nice and very appreciative of their parenting and whatnot. And my parents weren't perfect, and I don't want to get into the nitpicking, but so I'm not delusional that way. And each of my siblings probably has a different story to tell. But overall, you know, a lot of good things to look towards. And like I was talking about in those episodes, it's like me and all my siblings, we've always gotten along. we all get along with each other's partners and kids. There's a lot of love whenever we have an event. Everyone shows up and stays for the whole thing. There's no complaining. There's no fighting. There's no, you know, the kinds of things that you will hear about at family get-togethers, like the one uncle that goes off on MAGA or something, or the one cousin that always wants to fight or creates awkward situations, or I don't know, just very, or the brother that shows up late every time and talks about himself all the time. You know, there's nothing like that. Everyone is really, you know, well adjusted, you know, on for the most part. And so I had no idea that my parents would feel that they weren't good parents. They just seemed to have all the reasons in the world to believe otherwise. And so to kind of, because what happened was I was recorded the first episode with my mom. And at the end, after I stopped recording, I said, oh, you know, we have so many questions to get to. There's a lot of questions that they have about me as a child, but there's also a lot of questions that the listeners had for you, Mom, that people wanted to ask you about your parenting and about your daycare expertise, because I'm often talking about that. And my mom kind of had this face, and I was like, well, what's up with that? And she says, well, I don't feel like I have anything to offer. I don't feel like I have any advice that I can, I don't think there was anything special about my parenting or my work as a daycare, you know, facilitator, someone who owned a daycare. I don't think I have any expertise to offer. And I was like, huh, Mom, what are you talking about? Like, you are one of the most experts of child development and parenting that I've ever met. And I know a lot of experts in this area. You just picked up on it naturally and through experience, and not only raising as kids. I have to cough. Hold on. I'm going to pause the recording. Wow. If you could hear that cough, you would say, Kirk, stop podcasting. At least until you feel better. Let me have some of my hot or lukewarm honey water. Okay, so yeah, I investigated more when we were talking after I stopped recording. I was like, well, what do you mean? And she basically told me that she felt like she was a terrible parent, just full stop, without any qualifications to that. You know, it'd be one thing if my mom said something like, well, yeah, I think I did a pretty good job, but man, I just really regret having done this, this, and this. I think that's pretty normal, particularly for moms, but you know, any parent. But it wasn't that. It was full stop, baseline, I'm not a good parent. I was never a good parent. You kids are so great just because of you. You know, she was attributing all of our happiness and whatnot to just us in spite of their parenting, kind of a thing. And then when I said, you know, well, what about your daycare? I mean, obviously, you knew you were good with the kids. I mean, she was a master with those kids. She, you know, there were 10 4-year-olds, 3-year-olds running around in our house, and my mom knew exactly how to corral them. Whenever there's a new kid, there's a bit of an adjustment, but it's pretty quick. And I always just marveled at that because, you know, 3-4-year-olds, some of them can be pretty rambunctious. And my mom not only was able to corral them, but to make them happy in the process, you know, never was stern or mean to them. Just knew how to engage, you know. It's sort of like when experts teach me and my wife how to train our dogs. They talk about how to get your dog's attention because, you know, your dog, you're walking the dog and the dog is distracted, sees another dog and wants to run over there and bark. You're saying, hey, you know, like with Obi, I'll be like, Obi, Obi, Obi. And you think that the dog is ignoring you. But the truth of the matter is the dog doesn't hear you. They, you know, it's not registering to them because there's a much more interesting thing that's happening, a threatening thing that's happening. And, or they think you're actually wanting them to do it or something. So the key with these kind of trainings is to try to be more interesting than the dog, or get them away from the dog and then be more interesting. So you have to be like, you know, Obi, 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 hey, Obi, over here, Obi, hey, come on, let's do that. You know, so there's a way of and my mom just knew how to do that without any training, mind you. And with, you know, terrible parenting that was modeled to her as a child. So, and anyway, so I'm hearing this. She's like, not only was I a terrible parent, but I was a terrible daycare owner and stuff. And again, there wasn't any story there. It wasn't a thing like where she said, oh, I'm a terrible daycare owner because I hid a lot from you. You know, I did this and I did that and I did that. You know, I lost my temper and, you know, you just never saw it because you were at school during the day. You know, there was nothing like that. It was just this amorphous conclusion based on nothing. And I thought, oh my God, my mom has, and my dad, I think, they're so good at masking that from others, including their shrink of a son, right? That's been, you know, quietly and not so quietly analyzing them since I was trained in this profession 25 plus years ago. And I just never picked up on it. I didn't see it. I didn't see evidence of it. My parents are just really good at, you know, I think they come from a generation or a culture or something where you just don't bother other people with your stuff. You always put on a good face. And I'm not going to say that my parents are unhappy, but I mean, at least I hope they're not. But I think that they just, you know, suffer quietly, I think. And it just breaks my heart. And so when we concluded after that first recording and I'm hearing this and I'm like, oh my God, Mom. And seemed like my mom was basically what my mom was saying is, don't ask me questions about my parenting or the daycare because I don't have anything to offer the people. I don't think anyone would want to listen to what I have to say about that. And I thought, huh. And I can't remember everything that was said, but I basically concluded, oh, so I should just like not address that. So in the second recording that I did with my mom, I didn't go there. Plus, there were a lot of questions about my childhood. And half of the questions that y'all submitted or more were about me as a child, which I totally get. Got a cough again. Okay, that one was kind of long. where was I? Yeah, so in the second recording, I didn't ask my mom any of those questions. And then in the third recording, though, about halfway through, it just seemed to be a natural place to bring it up. And I was willing to cut it all out if my mom indicated, like, I don't want to go here. But she didn't. And she approved of all the, you know, I edited them and sent them to both my parents, and they both signed off on all three before I published them. And I listened back to it, the recording of the third episode, the third chapter, and I stand by a lot of what I said, but some of the tone I was having, I think I was scared for my mom because my parents are, you know, they're around 80, and I remember my grandparents were doing pretty well until they hit 80, and then things, you know, definitely start taking a downturn. You start having dementia issues potentially, you start having strokes potentially, you start having mobility issues potentially, you start having increased pain. When you go to the doctor with certain issues, you know, they start saying things like, well, you know, we could treat that, but it might be just not worth it in the end because you don't have that many years left. And I mean, I don't know how many, what they say precisely, but you know, that kind of talk. And so, my parents are pretty healthy, so maybe they'll last a long time, but I start to worry about the end for my parents. And I really worry also about my parents leaving this planet still believing that they weren't good parents. I mean, it was so much and still is so much of what they put their effort into. I mean, you know, my parents didn't have really outside hobbies that they were known for, you know? They did things occasionally, but often with us. You know, if my dad went fishing, he would go fishing with us. Oof, I had to pause it there. Sudden cough onset. And my dad golfed a lot, but he always wanted to golf with us. We just never took it up. Me and my brothers just never took to golf, really. So, but he would have golfed with us all the time if we would have done it with him. Anyway, so they put so much effort into their parenting, and they did so well. You know, they made mistakes, but yeah, I mean, when I think about, I honestly can't think of, I'm sure maybe they're out there in the depths of my memory banks, but I can't think of an even close second in terms of and maybe I'm biased, but in terms of the skill that my parents exhibited, the care, the stability, the lack of chaos, the lack of conflict, the lack of issues, the lack of contempt. So it breaks my heart that because of their early childhood trauma, they just have this schema. And by the way, I've been talking with my mom more about the discoveries that we made in that third chapter, and she's furthering her self-awareness, which I think is a good thing. And I think it's giving her a direction to explore for herself, which gives me hope for the future. So yeah, I think I was scared in chapter three, and listening back to it, I think I was, I don't know, it's almost like I was angry at my mom for doing that to herself. I guess I was angry at the part of herself that had been internalized by her early childhood that was telling her that she wasn't a good mom. And so, I don't know, looking back, I just kind of wish I had a more compassionate tone to it that I vow to myself that I will exhibit moving forward. You know, the podcast recording was kind of the first phase of my reaction, you know, like it was so shocking. And in that chapter three, it was kind of the first time we'd really gotten into it. And I think I was in a state. I was shocked and upset and ashamed of myself for not having noticed and not having done anything about it. And I said this in the episode. I'm like a plumber that lives in a house where his plumbing is falling apart. You know, who am I if not put on this planet to give back to my parents who gave me so much, and to have neglected that, to have neglected to notice it, is a massive transgression. So, you know, I was upset at myself, and I don't know, I just came across as being a little harsh, I think. And I think I also don't realize how entrenched these beliefs can be for people, and how little how little space is made for people to explore this, you know? Because for me, in my world, I'm very used to introducing topics like this and immediately just accepting the possibility and exploring them. But for my mom, I get the impression that she's literally never even consciously thought about it before and has always just lived with this as a baseline, as this monkey on her back that is she just takes for granted. And to voice it, to bring it out into the open, like the way I was doing, it was a very new place. I don't want to say she was uncomfortable, because she didn't exhibit that, but that it was confusing, I think, is one way to put it. It was a lot happening all at once for her, but for me, this is what I live in, you know. And so I think I was kind of racing a little bit, thinking she would come along with me, but she needs time. So anyway, let's go on with this email. I'll have to cough. Hold on. Okay, short cough. Anonymous middle tier patron, she says, "Hello, I wanted to see your opinion on some of the behaviors I see in my sister." And by the way, when you email in, if you can keep it short, it's better. I can always ask you, and sometimes I do. I'll be like, "Hey, can you give me some more information here?" The other thing I want to remind everyone is that there's no way I can answer everyone's emails, even if you're a patron. I try to, but it's just not possible, given the amount of emails we get. If you're more of an upper tier patron, it's more likely that your emails will be addressed. By the way, that's actually a big factor, is that sort of thing. But, and I get it, you know, people email in, they'll just be like, "Hey, you know, you never, I've sent in half a dozen emails and you've never answered any of them on the podcast. What's going on here?" And what I would say to that is, we get too many emails and it really bums me out that I can't do it. And two, it's probably just bad luck, because if someone's sending in six emails or something, and I didn't answer any of them, it's probably just really terrible luck, because, you know, chances are that's going to happen. So the other thing is, of course, you just can't depend on a podcaster to help you with these sorts of things. You know, the emails are, to me, more of a jumping off point to talk about things than me directly helping an individual. You know, if you need help with something, then you absolutely deserve to have people with you in person helping you and tailoring their advice or help to you specifically. So, all right. So my sister is 27, 5 years younger than me, and we're pretty close. It is getting to the point where it's hard to talk to her and spend time with her because she refuses to seek help for obviously problematic behaviors. There are many issues, like being verbally abusive and outright mean quite often. But my biggest issue is that I notice that she loves to ask people for favors, big and small, mostly big, even though she has no intention of actually using whatever resource she would gain from the favor. For instance, she had me talk to my past three employers to get her a job, and then she interviews and never shows up or calls on her first day. She asked me to ask my church if they'll baptize her, and then she won't attend the service. She will sign leases and pay deposits on apartments and never move in. She bought puppies and sold them the next morning. Eesh. She's had multiple pregnancies. She talks about names of the children. She has people buy things for the baby, and at the last possible minute, she gets an abortion. I'm going crazy because she constantly asks for favors that involve me overextending myself in different parts of my life, and she makes me look bad as a constant no-show. Chiming in here, meaning that, you know, when her sister says, hey, get me a job, and then the middle-tier patron says to her boss, hey, you know, da-da-da, and then her sister doesn't show for the first day, that kind of thing. She's had over 100 jobs, and I don't think she's ever given a two-week notice. She just stops showing up after a few days. Luckily, she tends to be very well-liked because she's one of those people who is very trendy, cool, and pretty. She won't follow through with therapy, although she'll make the appointment and not go. Is she just indecisive, or is this some kind of personality disorder? End of email. Well, if your description is close to accurate, patron, this doesn't... indecisiveness can be a part of a personality disorder, so those aren't mutually exclusive, but something serious is going on. I mean, when I first started reading the examples, I thought, well, you know, but then I hear more of these, oh my God. I mean, you say she's had over 100 jobs, and you don't think she's ever given two-week notice? She's 27, and she's had over 100 jobs, and most, if not all of them, she just ghosts the workplace. Now, the tempting conclusion is that she's entitled because she's pretty and trendy and cool, as you put it, and she uses that to her advantage. And maybe she does, but that's not, there's a lot of trendy, pretty, cool people in the world who would never do anything like this. So there's obviously something going on there. And there's not much there other than the behavior, right? And I don't know what's going on. It could be anxiety. She could have just crippling anxiety about making a choice or about committing to something, or I don't know, some kind of trauma there, some kind of PTSD there, some sort of phobia. I don't know. She could also have a personality disorder like histrionic. I haven't seen this presentation with histrionic, but the way it could work is that the individual, because of a trauma regarding attention growing up, she is in a constant state of trying to get attention in whatever way she can. And she knows through experience that if she pleads with people to help her with her job or naming her child or getting baptized or whatever, then she knows that if she can get people to, you know, I've heard from other people with histrionic personality disorder who, I've heard a lot of people in this category, also trendy, cool, pretty young women, you know, will tell me. So histrionic, anyone of any gender can have it of any age, but I've heard from a number of young pretty women, they will tell me that they're pretty, by the way, over email or something. So it's not that I'm evaluating them. But anyway, so they will tell me that their histrionic will manifest in them trying it's like a compulsion to get men to fall in love with her and to want to marry her or want to have sex with her, that kind of thing. And they'll tell me that they don't even really like the men, but they just want to know that they can get the man. And then once they get the man, and they'll tell me that they've ruined marriages. You know, the man will fall in love very quickly and then will call his wife and say he wants a divorce. And then the histrionic patient will tell me that at that point, she will break up with him and say, I don't want to see you anymore. Not because she's psychopathic, it's because she just has this constant need for attention and she doesn't know any other way to get it. And eventually she ends up in my office, you know, asking me for help because she has compassion, she has empathy, but she doesn't know why she's doing this sort of thing. And she, in the beginning, might confuse the compulsion with love or attraction, but what's really happening is this acting out of the histrionic. Anyway, so it could be something like that. I mean, given the level of behavior that you're describing, that would be my first hypothesis, but I don't know. It could be a lot of other things too. It could just be that she's just really picky about things and maybe a little self-centered. I wouldn't say narcissistic because it doesn't have any hallmarks of narcissism, although the internet would obviously label her as narcissistic, but that's not a common presentation of narcissism. She could have narcissism, but I'm not hearing anything along those lines. So, yeah, it's hard to say. At the very least, patron, what I would do is draw a boundary. Just say like, the next time she asks you for a favor, just, you know, actually one thing that I might experiment with if I were you, if you care to, you don't have to if you don't want to, is the next time she asks you for a favor, that instead you just give her regular attention and be like, oh, you really want me to do that? Oh, well, you know, let me think about that. But hey, let's talk about your life, you know, how are you doing? And it's possible that if she felt actually, because it's possible, given her traumas, that she's actually creating distance by doing this to people, right? Because this would create a lot of distance, a lot of anger and hostilities and rejection from other people once they catch on to the pattern, right? And so it might be creating this isolating effect for her that is reminiscent of what it was like for her growing up. And so if you put aside her asking for a favor and actually lean in and say, hey, you know, I like you and let's hang out and we're together. We're, you know, however it is that you can communicate or give the vibe that you're connected, you know, maybe that will diminish the compulsion. But I don't know. That's just kind of a long shot. It's hard to know what's going on there. But at the very least, you deserve to draw boundaries and not have your life impacted by what clearly is a pattern that's problematic. All right, let's take another break. All right, we're back from the break. This next email is from middle-tier patron therapist from Maryland, and she writes a long email here. I'm going to summarize. Basically, she's really nice. She wants to give me some constructive feedback, but she's being very kind to me in the process, which is good to do given my thin skin. And she says that there was an episode I published 7 years ago called A Critique of Cry It Out. And in that episode, apparently I, or the person I was interviewing, my guest, a colleague of mine, McCall from Antioch, she came on the podcast and from my memory was talking about how the cry it out method is inhumane and not the best practice with parenting. You know, when you're trying to sleep train your kids, there's various different options, and many of them are perfectly fine, but some of them are not so great, not so recommended. And so in that episode, I don't remember what she was saying or what I was saying because it was a long time ago, but it was some sort of comment on that. And if I remember right, my colleague McCall was really adamant about a particular opinion. I don't remember what it was. For me, when I work with parents, and I worked with a lot more parents in the past, but when I worked with parents regarding various different parenting issues, including sleep training, it was very apparent to me over time that there's a lot of different options regarding how to raise healthy and happy kids. And also, you have to tailor your parenting to the child. You know, often when we talk about parenting practices, we talk about, okay, at the age of two, you're supposed to do this. But any parent who actually experiences parenting knows that kids don't slot into these things easily. Kids have different sensitivities. Some kids are very easy. Some kids are very hard. Some kids are very anxious. Some kids are very mellow. Some kids are very happy. Some kids are more on the sad side. Independent of any sort of experiences they've been through parenting, you know, they just sort of emerge into the world with a disposition. Of course, the way they're treated adds to their presentation. But yeah, so in this email, the patron was being kind while saying that while she was listening to the episode, it really put her in a state of distress because it seemed like we were saying that if you sleep train your kids at all, then you are going to harm your children attachment-wise. And this patron is saying, I'm a therapist, I'm also a mother, and I looked at all the research, and sleep training can be done in a very attachment-oriented way, and I absolutely agree with that. I don't remember what I was saying in that episode, but if I did say or support something along the lines that of what you heard I was saying, that any sleep training is abusive to a child or something like that, the only thing I can think of as to why I would say something so stupid is because I lost my mind temporarily. But I think a more likely possibility is that at the time I was a sort of vocal proponent of attachment parenting and was being asked to be an expert on it on radio shows and other kinds of things. And at least that's my memory of that time. And I would be getting a lot of attacks from people, not only online, but also just in my personal life. You know, I would talk about how there's nothing wrong with breastfeeding your kid at when your kid's 6 years old. It's not a guarantee that that's the best way to do things, but it's not a guarantee that's a problem. We just have this phobia or this weird complex in our society around breastfeeding or around making sure our kids aren't spoiled. We go too far with that, and we need to be more attuned and more caring towards children and more age appropriate regarding what sort of things you want to push your children to do. So I was in a frequent state of feeling annoyed with people who were pushing back on these kinds of things. You know, you know, you'd have kids who still slept with their parents when the kids were like 8 years old. And I'd say like, yeah, culturally that's weird, but a lot of things are culturally weird. If you asked people in the American South in the 50s, is it culturally weird for blacks and whites to hang out together in a restaurant? They would say, yeah, it's culturally weird. Well, we understand that culturally weird is not an indication of a problem. So the fact that something feels weird or feels creepy doesn't mean that it's a problem. I think that should be obvious. And so in the past, I just get all these pushback from people in my personal life and otherwise, and I was just getting really annoyed. And so there's a possibility that I had a bone to pick, would say maybe some extreme things like anything other than attachment parenting is a problem, meaning that if you try to sleep train your kids or if you wean your kids too early or something, then you're a bad parent. I can't imagine saying something like that, but that's the only thing I think of. But you know, in your email, patron, you're being very nice, and I do apologize if I said something like that. You were also clear to make sure you're like, hey, you know, you record a lot of content. It's unreasonable to expect you to be on the ball all the time, and I agree with that for the most part, but, you know, I can edit these episodes, and I often do take stuff out that I don't agree with or flubs in my language, so I should have taken that out, or I shouldn't have had that published to say such a stupid thing. Not only just wrong, but also to make parents feel bad for doing things that are good for their family. So, yeah, I apologize. All right, this next email is from middle-tier patron Jen. She says, I listened to your apology deep dive, and I wanted to ask you a question. I received an apology from one of my son's teachers, and I'd love for you to analyze it. Please tell me if it is as much of a non-apology as I perceived it to be. For reference, the teacher is apologizing because I contacted the principal after the teacher ridiculed my 11-year-old son in front of the class after my son stuck up for a girl in his class that the teacher was being aggressive with. The teacher went on to call my son wimpy, and he threatened him. Okay, we'll just chime in here before I read the apology. Patron Jen, I'm guessing that you heard an account from the child, from your son, and although your son might be a very good narrator of reality, it's also possible that your son interpreted things in a different way. I don't know, maybe you have a lot of angles of data from a lot of people in the room, but just starting off, it's just hard to know what exactly happened. If it's anything close to the truth, this is awful. I mean, not only did he, the teacher, attack your son verbally and threaten him, that's awful, just full stop, but also did so because the teacher was being aggressive with another student, and your son stuck up for the other student, and then the teacher attacks your son. I mean, if this is close to the truth, then you have a much bigger problem on your hands than just a non-apology. So I hope you are talking with the principal about your concerns. I mean, this could be a very dire situation, but just going on with your email. So here is the apology that I received. During a meeting this morning, so this is from the teacher to the patron. During a meeting this morning, the principal relayed to me the communication you had with him regarding the effects that things I have said in class have had on your son. I was happy to hear that this was the case. I was unhappy. I was unhappy to hear that this was the case, and immediately asked if it would be okay to approach your son privately to express my regrets. Okay, so right off the bat, sounds like the teacher is agreeing with what your son is saying if he says he regrets what he did. But it also sounds like the teacher wasn't aware that he made the mistake. You know, it'd be different if the teacher said, yeah, I heard from the principal that your son and you went to the principal, but I was already regretting what I had done or something. So there's something there. But anyway, just going on here. So I was unhappy to hear that this was the case and immediately asked if it would be okay to approach your son privately to express my regrets. The principal rightly noted that sometimes that can make a situation worse and that contacting you first would be wise. Just chiming in here. I mean, certainly apologizing to the kid would be the best thing, and maybe also contacting the parent. I don't know why you'd have to contact the mom first, but anyway. He is your son, so it is appropriate for me to apologize to you, and I do. If you think it would be helpful to your son, I would like to apologize to him as well. Whether or not that is the case, I will certainly redouble my efforts to be judicious in the things that I say to my students and will be especially sensitive to your son. End of email. Okay, well, what do I think about this apology? So you're contending, patron, that it's a non-apology. Well, as far as non-apologies go, this does not reflect that. Might it be a non-apology? Maybe. I'm guessing what you are hoping for as a parent is much more elaborate, you know, wording there of the teacher saying, yeah, I have this problem, I was having a bad day, it doesn't make, you know, something that would demonstrate that the teacher was reflecting on the situation. But in terms of what he's actually saying verbatim, it does demonstrate that he's taking responsibility. He's not blaming anyone else. He says he regrets what he did, and that he's trying to stop himself from doing this in the future. Even if this is a sincere apology, I would still be gravely concerned about this teacher in general, that the teacher did something like this, was, as you say, being aggressive with one student, and then your son stuck up for that student, and the teacher then turned on your son, called him wimpy, and threatened him. I mean, that's definitely a fireable offense, or at the very least, major sanctions. An apology is not sufficient. If this was my kid, I'd be very adamant that there be a supervisor in the room for the next several months or so. Like, something should happen, because that is not okay. So I would go to the principal. I'm guessing you sent this email a while ago, so maybe that's already been resolved. But yeah, so you know, I'm guessing emotionally for you, patron, this apology doesn't, you know, suffice, which I could understand. But in terms of whether or not it constitutes a non-apology, in my eyes, it doesn't. So yeah. All right. Well, that does it for that episode. Everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do.